your source for everything paranormal.
Para-X.
The views expressed and the opinions given by the individual host and their guests do not necessarily reflect those of Para-X, its affiliates, or its sponsors.
Merry meet and merry part, bright the cheeks and warm the heart. For tread the circle thrice about, to keep unwelcome spirits out. Bide within the law you must, in perfect love and perfect trust. Mind the threefold laws you should, three times bad and three times good. These eight words the reed fulfill, and ye harm none, do what ye will.
Welcome to Stirring the Cauldron on the Para-X Radio Network. And now, here's your host, Marla Brooks.
Hey, merry meet everybody, and welcome to the show. My guest tonight is author and psychic Lauren Leo, and he's traveled throughout Europe, North Africa, and the Middle East, and his fascination with the occult led him to study the Kabbalah and methods of divination. And there are the catalysts for his writings, they are. And he provides spiritual counsel also at his metaphysical bookstore, New Moon Books, Crystals, and Candles. And he was here a couple of months ago talking about his really good book, Horse Magic. And today we're going to be talking about his fiction book called Love's Shadows, Nine Crooked Paths. And we've got a lot to talk about. And so, Lauren, hi, pop in.
Hi, Marla. Thank you for having me back.
Oh, thank you for turning me on to the book, because I really, really, really did like it. But before we jump into that, I just want to mention to everybody that when we come back from our mid-show break, you're actually going to read one of the stories from the book, and then we can kind of talk about it afterwards. So thank you for agreeing to do that.
Absolutely. Yes, I'm going to read In the Moors. It's one of my favorites, one of my favorite short stories from the collection.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. I mean, well, the whole book. I finished it. I did all the chapters, and today I did the. I wanted to save one for last, you know, and so yeah, that was really good. But okay, so this book is unlike any of the others that you've talked about on the show. And as I mentioned before, this is fiction, but certainly it's way different than the run-of-the-mill love stories that people are used to hearing, you know, the Hallmark variety or whatever, Barbara Cartland. But so what muse tapped you on the shoulder and decided you should write a book like this?
You know, that's a good question, because really it came from my psychic ability. So I would be in a trance state, half awake, half asleep, and I would have a vision. And the vision that would come to me would be, for instance, I saw a little boy in eastern India. I knew his name was Anik. I knew that he was deaf. And that vision would weigh on me, and I had to write about it. Mm-hmm. It was almost as if that character had come alive within me and wanted me to talk about his life. And then I would get wrapped up in the story, because it was so powerful. The character would take shape. But you know, even more, this is all about love. Mm-hmm. So at the time when I started writing this book, you know, love is, there's always something hidden when it has to do with real love. You know, there's always some loss or boredom or tiny hate that we would never tell a soul about love. Mm-hmm. So really, ultimately, love was the inspiration and the muse that came to me. And it did take over. My psychic ability did take over. And so I can make a delineation between creativity and psychic ability. And actually, no, I can't. There is no delineation. I believe that psychic ability and imagination and creativity all lie on a parallel line. Mm-hmm. So once I started having a vision, I started writing about it, and it started to take on its own life. And I had to write about it. And then when you get into love and the inspiration of love, mm-hmm. you know, it becomes even more deep. Mm-hmm. So they're psychic love stories there. That's the best way to talk about it, mixed with spells, mixed yes. with true factual evidence.
Mm-hmm. It was really refreshing to read something so original, as opposed to the things that, you know, okay, it's a love story. You know, I mean, we all do that. So, I mean, it was nice. And, you know, I've talked about this before on the air about writing fiction as opposed to nonfiction. But I want to see if you had a similar experience like I did in the process. Because in writing both my fiction books, I didn't go in with, like you just kind of talked about this a minute ago, I didn't go in with a detailed outline. I didn't have a character development, you know. I mean, I had a list of basic characters. I didn't have the plot lines out there or anything else. And, you know, it was nothing that the preferred method of writing fiction is supposed to be, I guess, you know. Following the rules. I just had a germ of an idea, and the first sentence was in my head. And you knew, you know, like you knew the boy and had to write about it. But I sat in front of the computer and I waited to see what came. And it just started to flow. And it was like reading a book rather than writing one. I didn't know what was coming on from page to page. So clearly, I mean, my muse recognized that I was in need of a great deal of help and jumped in. But so how was that for you? I mean, did it, I mean, you had the germ of the idea, like you said before, but did you know how the story was going to continue? I mean, did you have it in your mind or did it just kind of flow?
It flowed. The first experience I had was I had a vision that I was at a wedding. I knew it was a gypsy wedding. I knew that the gypsy princess's name was Aviana. And let me be clear, because this is not my imagination. This is an actual vision that I had. Mm-hmm. So it guided me. This was a non-self, you know, structure. So it came to me as a vision, and from there it flowed. I knew there was a clairsentient feeling of what I had to write about. I knew that it was all about Princess Aviana, how she was going to get to her wedding, and all of her trials and tribulations that led up to her having a good wedding, a good life, and it was not going to be typical. And so my psychic ability acted as a muse, but it gave me characters. It gave me Princess Aviana. It gave me Anik, the deaf Eastern Indian boy. It gave me the goddess White Tara. And it slowly started to form. So it didn't come all at once, but it slowly started to appear so I could weave the stories together. I didn't know that there were going to be 9 short stories, but I did know that there was going to be a collection. So there was no rhyme or reason other than just knowing that I had to write it. And mm-hmm. when I sat down to write it, one of my biggest inspirations was music. I would put on music. And, mm-hmm. You know, some of the music echoes our distress, right? It either echoes our distress or it echoes our joy, and it helps us emote. And I believe that you can't write without using magic and creativity. You have to have some kind of inspiration and imagination. And I found that the music that I listened to, which I mention in the book, actually helped me pull together a lot of the themes. Because at first, the themes, even though they were there, they were clear. I knew that I saw the ending first. It was the wedding for Princess Adiana. I still didn't know exactly where I was going to start. So it was still nebulous. And the music helped guide me through the weaving process and to create stories. I would say that music, psychic ability, and creativity were my muse and inspiration.
Yeah, and we all need it. I mean, it's funny because when I was writing my book, it's kind of I don't know, can't even explain it. It's not a Harry Potter at all, but it has similar aspects to it. But all of a sudden I was getting things that, like, I had a five-headed dragon in the story. And I found a five-headed dragon glass figure, and I had to buy it. And then one of the other things that I talked about in the book was a Merkaba, and I had to get one. You know, so there were, with me, it was objects that were there, and there was a quote, something about magic happens or something, and I found a plaque that said that. So I was kind of looking at things as inspiration too, just in front of me, because I had to get the dragon. I had to get, you know, and it worked out that way. So yeah, there's always a way that we get in, and it puts us in a comfort zone, and it helps the writing keep flowing. So
it does. It's these wonderful affirmations that actually come to us. So, you know, you're talking about the affirmations that were around you that started to appear, and it's letting you know you're on the correct path.
Yeah.
You're creating. You're in the midst of creating. And I think for me, each story, as it adapted, became a very personal story for me. It started to pull in part of my own personal experience. And then I would study. I would learn about the facts of, for instance, when I read In the Moors later in the evening, I started reading about Portugal and the Napoleonic Wars. I wanted to actually see what was going on in real life. So I'm able to actually tune in and weave a story that actually makes sense. So if someone looked up the name, you know, Duke Arthur Wellesley, that man exists. And, you know, it was what vibrated for me. I think that's the best way to say it. It's like walking through a pyramid, a tomb of the past, and finding yourself in another dimension and gathering those vibrations and bringing it back. It was deeply meaningful.
You know, that's the beauty of writing, because as people, when we read books that other people have written, it takes us away. We go to where the book is and, you know, the different places that are mentioned. But also when you're writing, you know, we're setting the tone and we're there. I mean, I saw all the locations that I made up, but I saw them as real in my head. I mean, I knew, you know, what it looked like and what this tapestry looked like or something like that. It was always very clear. And that's the beauty of writing, because as we write, I mean, yes, there's the grammatical part and, you know, some of the technical stuff that kind of gets picky after a while. But it's so, it just takes you away just to write. I mean, and I'm sure you've noticed this too. You sit down and it's 11 o'clock in the morning and you're sitting there and thinking, oh, it should be lunchtime now. And you look and the clock says 3 o'clock. We get, you know.
You get carried away. Yes. With it, and that's when you know something wonderful is happening. And, yeah. You know, there's also this part of me and I'll share this with you and your listeners. There's a part of me that I enjoy tangled human moments. I like that. Mm-hmm. I like to really delve into people's hearts. I don't want something easy. I want something that's going to baffle people. I want something that is, you know, I'm a bit of a twisted knot sometimes, and I want to look into what does that mean? I want something interesting to happen. So I have to look for intellectual stimulation and emotional stimulation consistently. Mm-hmm. And with that, it helps me emote and it helps me write. It's a multidimensional process. It really is. And mm-hmm. That's what you're talking about as well. You sit down at 12 o'clock to start writing, and the next thing you know, it's 3 or 3:30.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's amazingly wonderful. It really is.
Yeah.
I was going to say we're going to talk a little bit about Crooked Paths and Love's Shadow, but let's address the subject of love for a minute, because to me, even though you can find the word in the dictionary, I don't think that love is something that you can define by words. I always think of it as an emotion felt differently to each individual in a variety of circumstances and, you know, throughout our lifetime. And with that emotion, there's always another attached. So it's love and happiness, love and sadness, love and uncertainty, and the list goes on. So love drives us to sometimes crooked paths and comes out with a lot of different shadows, which I think is captured in every story in your book. Am I on the right track here?
Most certainly. When I think of the concept of love, there's so many substructures, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because there's romantic love, intimate love, familial love, friendship, agape. There's so many substructures, but really what determines love? What does love really mean? So and it changes for each person at each age. You know, I remember being in my teens and someone saying, oh, you don't know what love is. You're too young. Mm-hmm. Well, really, when you're in your teens, it's when love is the most intense.
Mm-hmm.
So it's how do we define love? And I've noticed that love in this book, Love Shadow, Nine Crooked Paths, took on a little more of a dark and sinister turn, because mm-hmm. as we grow, as we mature, we become more wise. We know what we want more of. We know what we want less of. But for some reason, throw in lust, passion, and love, and you get lost in the woods. You know, it's mm-hmm. very, very difficult.
Yeah.
So these paths that I created were paths that treated love as a narcotic. It treated love as a medicine. It treated love as a healing balm. And it also looked at the dark side of love. Why are you in love with this person? What do you want? What's your agenda? What does it really mean to have this love? And that's where the psychic side came in. You know, in one of the short stories, I talk about a witch that actually stabs out all of the negativity from Princess Adiana's love line, and she does it with a needle. So mm-hmm. she plucks out all that's bad. So she's explaining to the main character, look, you think you're in love. You're not. You're with someone that is going to beat you. You're with someone that is not treating you with power and respect. So love can fool us, and love can take on these dark turns. And that's where the nine crooked paths came into play. I don't think that love can be completely defined. I think it changes consistently. Mm-hmm. And at one point, it can plateau. And that's when you have to understand, well, is it reciprocated? And nothing is ever reciprocated 100% perfectly. Mm-hmm. And that's where the conundrum comes in, and ergo the ninth path. Most mm-hmm. love stories end in tragedy.
Right. And that, and you know, without giving anything away, we talked about this before, but these stories seem to be independent of each other and can be enjoyed as such. But, you know, I kept reading and reading, and then when I got to chapter 8, there was this big surprise, this explanation as to the purpose of the first 7 stories. And it really made me smile. And all the shadows from all of those up to 8, when I read the last chapter, it just kind of closed around me and went, okay, this is all good. You know, I mean, it's very cleverly written in that respect.
It somehow came together at the very end. So I saw the end first. I saw the wedding. Without giving anything away. Mm-hmm. I did see the end. I saw some of the main characters in my mind's eye, and I knew I had to write about it. But there was one point where there was a definite demarcation in how I was writing, and it was towards the end, and I knew that the entire book at this point was just going to change. It somehow had tricked me into writing what it wanted me to write. I feel almost as if the spirit wanted me to write this book for a very particular reason. Mm-hmm. And the last portion, the last short story, pulls it all together, and it shocked even me as I was writing it.
See?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it brought a really beautiful, it brought a beautiful conclusion.
Yeah.
And concluding note. And I like concluding notes. I like mm-hmm. something that's satisfying. I think most people do. When we talk about some of the classics, like the Bronte sisters and whatnot, you get love stories that give you everything you want. Mm-hmm. They fill you with a certain sense of satisfaction, yet at the same time, when I wrote this book, you're not going to get happy endings all the time. Right. Because true love does not end happy. Not all the time. Sometimes mm-hmm. it does. Mm-hmm. So it's more truthful. It felt like it was truthful, and I was trying to analyze something as well. There were missing puzzle pieces in my life at that time that I wanted to bring together. And it helped me by writing. So, you know, the using psychological tools were important during the entire time period I was writing.
And I had no clue. I mean, I was very surprised at the ending. I mean, I did not see that coming. I was just kind of following, you know, the whole book and, okay, well, here's, you know, another shadow and whatever. And I just, you know, I got to the last page and I was like smiling, you know, because it wasn't something that, you know, I hate it when you're reading something or watching something on TV and you can see what's going on all along. You can just, you know, okay, this is going to happen and this is going to happen and this is going to happen because they telegraph, you know, what's going to happen. And not so with this. And so I was just like, okay, I was really good. And now I want to go back and read them all again just to kind of, you know, put it all together to see if the second reading is going to make it more sense when you read than the first time. Because, you know, sometimes I like to read things over and over again. So I am definitely going to read it again. But is there any significance actually to the number 9, which is the number of stories you've included in the book? Or because you said a minute ago you knew that there would be 9. Why 9?
So the number 9, let me preface this with I studied through the Golden Dawn and the Kabbalah, and the number 9 represents a sphere known as the moon in the Kabbalah. And the moon, as we know, waxes and wanes. And I believe that our shadow self waxes and wanes. I believe that love and passion waxes and wanes. So the number 9 became very important on an esoteric level. And this is where I like that it's more hidden, it's more veiled in through a gossamer veil, because if it's too out in the open, and I actually put in the book, well, there are 9 paths because it has to somehow be associated with the number 9 in the Kabbalah, it loses its effect. So talking about it with you actually will help anyone who's reading the book. So it is associated with the waxing and waning of our lives and our passions. And it has to do with the new moon, the full moon, the dark moon. So it did take on a very special interest. And from the beginning, actually, I just, as it started happening, as the as each short story was being written, I just knew that I was going to end up with 9, and that it had to have that esoteric association with it.
Yeah, yeah. Sometimes subconsciously it builds and builds, and finally you realize, oh, this is the right thing to do. I knew, you know, you knew it all along, but you didn't know it all along until it happened. But yeah, I kept thinking significance. Okay, what is this? What's the number 9? And I'm thinking of astrology. I'm thinking of numerology, you know. And yeah, that makes good sense. All right, well, I think we're going to take a break. So when we come back, Lauren is going to be reading stories, The Moors. So stay put, and we will be back in 2 minutes.
Stirring the Cauldron will be right back, so don't go away.
If you end up with webbed feet,
remember, you've been warned. Missed an episode of Stirring the Cauldron? Then be sure to check out MarlaBrooks.com and check out the archive. And while you're there, check out Marla's weekly Witches Oracle card reading. Explore the site to find many great resources, such as information on tarot, oracle readings, metaphysical consultations, and links to all of Marla's books. That's MarlaBrooks.com.
Rat! Rat! going?
I'm going back to the paranormal view, back where I belong.
Please, please, take me with you.
No, I'm through with everything here. I want to see if there's something left in life I haven't explored. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Oh, Rhett, don't run to them. They talk about ghosts and hauntings, UFOs and all kind of supernatural scary stuff.
You'll never understand, will you, Scarlet?
No!
Well, that's your misfortune.
Rhett, if you go, where shall I go? What shall I do?
Frankly, my dear. Line.
Oh, you gotta be kidding.
That's the Paranormal View with your host, Henry Foister, Jeffrey Gould, and Barbara Duncan. Every Saturday night at 8 p.m. Eastern, exclusively on the Para-X Radio Network.
Welcome back to Stirring the Cauldron. Once again, here's your host, Marla Brooks.
Okay, welcome back, as the guy said, and my guest tonight is Lauren Leo, and we're talking about his book, Love Stories, Nine Crooked Paths. And now it's story time. So, Lauren, you can tell us a little bit about the story that you chose, and then proceed to the telling.
So I'm going to read the second short story. It's called In the Moors. And let me preface it with, there's a part that I discuss, and it has to do with the Napoleonic Wars. So in the early 19th century, the French invaded Portugal. And I talk about the colors of their flag, and it's very important that I'm explaining this, because if you don't know the colors of the flag, you don't know what's going on in the story. And at one point, and this is true, it's factual, there is a man by the name of Arthur Wellesley, who's the first Duke of Wellington, who pushed the French out of Porto. So I actually have his name in this second chapter. And it's for good reason, and I think that that's a good enough preface, and we'll get it from there.
Okay.
So we'll start with that. This is about a nanny who is not what she seems to be, and she's psychic, and she's quite powerful. So we'll start with that. Okay. Despite her miraculous ability to quiet children, cure colic, and make one's complexion glow or fade, the household was happy to see Edelmira leave the manor house, turning an otherwise tragic occasion fortuitous. The cook, gossiping over tea, would say in her Cockney accent, "I seen her walk by a flower and make it wilt. She sucked the life right out of it, like a harpy she is." The servants were not the only ones threatened by this otherworldliness. The lady of the manor, clever and shrewd as she was, could not find a way to convince her husband, Duke Arthur, to dispose of what she thought of as an aberration. To make matters worse, she knew, as did most of society, that the child he brought back from Portugal more than 10 years ago was not only the new nanny, but in fact his illegitimate daughter. Driven by jealousy, the Duchess would say in an affected Queen's English, "You should never have brought her here, Arthur. She does not belong. She is more like a ghost than a nanny, floating barefoot through the halls in a white dress, appearing when least expected. Why not give her to the Dawsons in Danbury? She would fit in better there, surrounded by the moors, hidden in the mist and fog." Having endured the Napoleonic Wars, the Duke was unyielding in his decision to keep his daughter close. The moment he died, however, the Duchess seized her chance for revenge. And so, one gloomy morning, 3 months before Edelmira's 28th birthday, she was abandoned once more, put out like a deformed infant, left at the doorsteps of a palatial, far-off country manor. With no one there to greet her, Edelmira sat on her pine traveling chest and fixed her gaze on the manor's unwelcoming front doors. She wondered what fate awaited her on the other side of the threshold. A dragonfly hovering closely seemed to answer. "You are soon to take care of a lonely little girl, Edelmira, who lost her mother at childbirth. Beware your mistress, a stepmother filled with spite. The lord of the manor, an unfortunate soul, is about to die from alcohol consumption." Edelmira accepted her future with unnatural ease, for what was incomprehensible to most was to her quite normal. Since childhood, her gift brought her a form of unique insight, allowing her to understand the bits of thought that were found behind the creation of physical matter. Reality, to her, was an illusion. An angel once told her in a dream, "The earth is a mosaic, and most fail to notice the gossamer tesserae floating down from the realm of the mind that form its images of beauty and horror." Of scenes of horror, Edelmira had plenty, but one in particular would dislodge itself from memory at her most vulnerable moments. It started as an inchoate feeling at the top of her head, slowly turned into panic, and then picked up speed until it gushed downwards, unstoppable like muddy waters rushing from an open floodgate. The only control she had was to bargain with it. "Take over my mind, but never my heart. Take over my mind, but never my heart." So painful were the emotions attached with the memory that she could endure only peripheral flashes. They had the Medusa's power. Facing them head on would turn her to stone. Sensing its approach, Edelmira hugged her knees for support. Through tightly shut eyes, she saw herself as a little girl playing in a sun-drenched field of tall wheat. A beautiful woman holding an infant watched on, smiling and content. From the left, a soldier in blue and white galloped towards them on horseback, gun in hand. Edelmira opened her eyes in an attempt to stop the inevitable. Instant nausea reminded her of the bargain, and with a deep breath, she closed her eyes again in assent. Now she saw herself hidden in the wheat. The pounding of hooves could not mask the sound of the soldier's gun. He fired into the beautiful woman's back once, twice, three times, as she ran from him in terror. In the 5 seconds it took to fall forward onto the ground, she had managed to pull her baby closer in a spasm of protection. But the innocent angel was pressed under her mother's dead weight, setting her soul free as well. Edelmira opened her eyes screaming, ending the scene in operatic tragedy. A high-pitched sound between her ears threw off her equilibrium. She returned to the memory just for a moment, staring in shock through blood-stained wheat all those years ago. Where were her mother and baby sister? But they were gone as soon as the vision faded. He must have been alarmed, opening the doors onto such a bizarre scene, the new nanny, silhouetted by the first rays of morning sun, staring at him with piercing green eyes, long blonde hair, and tears running over porcelain skin. But Mr. Dunn, having survived the past 62 years as the Dawson's manservant, held an inscrutable face and voice. "Good morning and welcome to Danbury. I am Mr. Dunn. You must be Alameda. I will be taking your traveling chest to your room now." Poor, unsuspecting Mr. Dunn. If only he could have known. He had accidentally mispronounced her name. She had long since given up correcting this offense. But today, after tackling the Medusa, boiling frustration was just waiting to be forced out. And like a high-pitched whistle from a teapot, she screamed her name at him in her mind. "Edelmira! Edelmira! Edelmira!" Suddenly, Mr. Dunn felt a bit confused and off balance. Regaining his composure, he finally asked, "I am sorry. Can you repeat that? My hearing is not what it should be." But there was nothing to repeat except a pause and a gaze. "My name means princess," she thought to herself, and wanted to cry even more. Instead, with flawless British English, Ed O'Meara spoke out loud for the first time. "I will be taking a morning walk first." Mr. Dunn raised an eyebrow. The gossip was true. He could sense it. She was the dead Duke's daughter. "Well, please do hurry. We are short of staff, and the mistress will..." Before he could finish his sentence, Ed O'Meara stood up, brushed herself off, and headed into the moors. On her way, a red grouse revealed itself. Its famous trill ending in go back, awakened a beautiful memory from her past. She could hear in her native language, "Wait for me, my love. I will find you, my love." A decade seemed like yesterday as she remembered the small boat she was on as it pulled away from Porto's shore. She was 17 years old, and those were the last words she would hear her lover speak, that they were enough to satisfy her for a lifetime. Through all the sadness and pain, Ed O'Meara's bargain worked. Her heart was untouched by bitterness. Smiling at this thought, she let warmth and love surface with the rising sun. Hidden by diaphanous clouds of mist and fog, floating gracefully over veils of heather and flowing runnels, she began to dance, swaying left and right, and leaping, jumping, prancing. It was a dance of freedom, a dance of strength. Celebrating with her, the spirits of the moors blessed her in her native tongue. "Invincible," they told her. "You are invincible." Back at the manor, Ed O'Meara's dance could be sensed by the lonely little girl from the dragonfly's message. Mysterious emotion, one bordering on hope and power, triggered her curiosity as she watched from the second floor window, trying to discern the movement she saw through the mist. The children's eyes, innocent and unconditional, see differently than adults. "Father," said the little girl, pointing at the window, "look, it's Princess, the horse you bought me for my birthday. She must have escaped from the stables and is prancing about." Without looking up and placating her, he responded, "Really, darling, where?" "Can't you see, Daddy? In the moors." The end.
I had to find my button. I muted you. yeah, and that, you know, and if anybody in the chat room has any questions or comments about the story or about the book or anything to ask, Lauren, now's your time. We've got some good time to kill here. That story just kind of made me stop and think really hard at the end, at first.
And I really, that's what I wanted. These short stories are called a slice of life in French. And what that means is that you're able to interpret it any way you like. They're meant to make you think. They're meant for you to read over and over. This is not a short story that you're going to read once. It's a short story that you're going to read and read again and try to interpret on your own. And and I did that purposely. It's a very difficult genre to write. Not that I'm an expert at all in this genre, but I delved into it because it fascinated me. It's a genre that leaves you hanging. Is Princess a horse? Is she really a nanny? Is she really someone that is psychic enough to speak to a dragonfly? Is she going to help this little girl? And is this little girl really seeing the magic of a horse totem or the magic of innocent eyes? It raises so many questions, and it raises the question, most importantly, of how formidable is your spirit? All of her energies came to her. They said, "You're invincible." So with all of this sadness, this illegitimate girl born out of wedlock in the 1800s, who's a nanny, who is left at a doorstep like a deformed infant, abandoned, out of all of this sadness, she has somehow found the ability to maintain not allowing bitterness into her heart. Mm-hmm. And she dances and she allows the warmth to come to her. So it's a story about inner strength. It's a story, really, about witchcraft and witches and what does it mean to be a witch? What does it mean to have the power within you to overcome all of the obstacles and all of the tragedies that life belies upon us? It's a very powerful, meaningful short story, all within 4 pages. And the ancestors coming to help her at the end, you're invincible. So it leaves a lot for self-interpretation.
Yeah, it does. And, you know, I mean, I read the ending, I went, wait, horse? Really? And you know, and it made me stop and think. But then when I was also reading the part where she was on the boat, you know, separated from him, that little bit of love right there, 3 or 4 words would hold her for a lifetime, and they were enough. Because I'm thinking, oh, that shouldn't be enough. But then I thought, that's me. That's not her. You know, I mean, she knew that she was loved so much that just that last little bit of parting, and you'll never see him again, probably. She kept that in her heart all the time, and I thought that was really wonderful.
It was resignation. And yeah. Resignation is very powerful. Mm-hmm. It's a very powerful doomsday feeling. Mm-hmm. And yet, she turned her resignation into becoming invincible.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, there's this constant theme that I use throughout the book of revenants and eidolons. So, you know, these are words for spirits and ghosts and disembodied spirits. So it's spirits and ghosts and people that are shy and that are hidden in the moors. She's out in the moors in these fields covered with mist and fog. Is she real? Is she not real?
Mm-hmm.
And does she need to hide? What is it that she's hiding? She'll never show the truth. She can't. Mm-hmm. It's done. Her father passed away. She's, you know, so it raises question after question.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not until you get to the end of the book that you realize that all of these short stories tie in together and have an overarching theme.
There's a comment in the chat room. Kathy said, well, this lesson learned in living in the moment, and I guess that's what she was doing too.
There you go, living in the moment. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because, you know, without living in the present, what's left?
Yeah.
So that's where her spirit was. You are invincible in that present moment. So yeah, it gives the ability to draw on powerful emotion. You know, there was another short story that I wrote that has to do with complete love and revenge. And it is, it's the one about, and I don't want to give too much away with it,
right.
but it's the one about Valentina, and she's a witch, and she's about to open up her birthright, and her birthright is from her grandfather, who is from Naples, Italy.
Mm-hmm.
And it meant a lot to me because my heritage, part of my heritage is from Naples. Mm-hmm. And I've been to Naples many times. And I've been to the area where a mystic, Padre Pio, lived. Mm. And Padre Pio was known as a Catholic mystic. I'm not sure. He may be a saint at this point.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
Yeah, well, he's definitely an ascended master, for sure.
Exactly. Yeah. And I used a lot of my experience from being in that small town and speaking to people in that town and put it into the other short story in the book. And I mixed it. I mixed it with love and revenge and showed just how dangerous it is. I show a woman that fell in love with a priest. And what would you do if you were given all of the power necessary to take back this priest and get him as your lover and finally have your true love? What would you do? Would you drink all of the potion? Would you drink just a little? So it raises the question of love and revenge. Mm-hmm. And once again, it's all about control. How do we control the passion and the love within us if we have that power?
Yeah, when I was reading that, when she got the instructions on the spell, you drink half of it, you're good. Drink it all, you might not want to do that. And I'm thinking, one minute you're thinking, okay, well, she'll abide by that. And then the next minute you're thinking, oh, she's going to drink the whole thing. There's so much food for thought in these stories. Just little simple bits, somebody saying, okay, well, here's a spell and this is how you should take it. It already you're starting to go through your head. What's she going to do? What's she going to do? Well, what would I do? And no, she may not do, I love to be able to read an intelligent story and make my mind work. This is always a good thing.
Yeah, it triggers, it creates intellectual conversation within your own dialogue. And, but my favorite short story out of the entire book is the last one.
Mine
Magdalene
too.
Bellish.
Yes.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm so happy and surprised to hear. Tell me why it's your favorite.
Well, again, partly because I didn't expect the ending, but it was you were like teasing all the way around. I mean, you left all the little clues of what could happen, but they could go one way or the other. And, you gave a little history of, what her life was like before and what it is now. I mean, it was so completely, thoroughly interesting that I was sorry that it ended. But I was happy the way it did, but I just wanted more, actually.
There was something about the way the last short story was constructed that was so powerful for me. I do love the opera, and on the last, and in fact, all the short stories have some kind of operatic experience involved with them. Because opera, as we know, is tragic, right? But it also can end on a beautiful note. But what moved me was the idea of all of the different chandeliers at the Met that were really created based on the Big Bang theory.
Yeah.
And I found it so fascinating that it held such a rich metaphor that it had to be used.
Yeah.
So it just started the last chapter with a big bang, and you know, it was just one of my favorites. And I like the way it ended in the sense of pulling everything together, and that happened, I believe, just naturally. That was not. I didn't set out to make that happen the way it happened. It just happened naturally.
Well, I'm glad it did. We're going to have to wrap up here pretty quick, but there is one question from the chat room. She wants to know if you're going to be on other shows coming up, and you know, you're going to tell everybody what you're doing and what you're up to and where people can find you. So if you're going to be doing other people's shows, where should she go and look to find out?
So anytime that I will be on another show, it will be posted on my Instagram, which is at Lauren Leo, and it'll also be on my store's website, newmoonbooks.org, and on my personal website, laurenleo.com. And it'll also be, I have Twitter, which is Lauren_Leo, and as well as Facebook. So it'll be put on social media, and I believe in late January, I have a couple more shows coming up, or podcasts, and other than that, there's always, if you go to newmoonbooks.org, you can download for free a free online resource, The Familiar, and that is my electronic magazine that I co-edit. And it has wonderful articles. It has spells. The latest one has a spell from Judy Hall. She wrote about crystals. There's Nicholas Pearson is in it. Temperance Alden, who just wrote the bestseller Year of the Witch, is in it. And those are wonderful free resources that it's my way of giving back to the witchcraft community and to the metaphysical community in general. But if you're interested in following me, and I'm on Instagram at Lauren Leo and laurenleo.com.
Great. Well, thank you so much. And thank you for writing the book. You know, it's been a long time since I just sat down and read something and totally enjoyed it. Not because it was a show book, you know, not that I had to read it, not like a book report. I truly enjoyed reading it. So thank you for doing that. And thank you guys for listening in. We got to get out of here. So until next time, everybody, blessed be and merry meet again. Good night.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Stirring the Cauldron with Marla Brooks. Please join us again next week at the same time for another great guest and more cauldron stirring. Any rebroadcast or other use of this program without explicit permission is strictly prohibited. Copyright 2024. The Mysterioso March by Kevin MacLeod is licensed through Incompetech.com.